some overtime. Oh, and your front desk staff need to monitor the behaviour of the custody officers in direct contact with the subject by CCTV at all times. External vault door control, not internal. The list goes on, seemingly endless. I'm still half convinced they'll slip up and let him walk away by the end of the weekend. The rest of the afternoon and early evening, I spend writing a report, eyes only, for Mrs. Jessica Green. I explain in words of one syllable exactly what the mandate is capable of, and why he was able to walk right into the door next to the Prime Minister's residence, and what the consequences would have been if we hadn't stopped him. A new PM, and then a new Home Secretary before the election. Footnote. It's not as if MPs don't die at random intervals during a parliamentary session, or even commit suicide. And if that happens, a by-election is called to fill the empty seat. Nor is it likely that a promising candidate with a golden tongue and high-level backing won't get elected if he stands in a safe seat, weeping crocodile tears for the MP who killed himself. Thankfully, there are no currently scheduled by-elections, so we don't have to add a murder investigation to the mandate's account. It's pretty hard to prove murder to a jury who are mesmerised by the accused, especially when the alleged victim, whichever MP the mandate had decided to replace, will almost certainly turn out to have left a suicide note. I'm pretty sure that trying the mandate is going to present the Ministry of Justice with a huge headache as it is. Maybe a tribunal of judges wearing wards and earplugs. But that's not our problem to worry about. The expected summons arrives in my email inbox around 7 o'clock. See me Monday, 9:30 a.m. It comes directly from the headmistress's appointment secretary. This is the first Home Office meeting I'm actually looking forward to, I realise. Even though I'm pretty sure that the reward for a job well done will be a royal bollocking for still not having found Freudstein. As I'm about to go home, I get a final email, this time from Jim. Score tickets for the final night of La Traviata at Covent Garden tomorrow at 8 p.m. Invitations to a reception afterwards. Want to eat first? We can make an evening of it. Ooh, sounds like fun. I smile to myself and send back, yes and yes. I pause. What's the party dress code? Black tie, he replies. Our host is a sheikh. The hospitality will be something special. Okay, I send. And just like that, I have a date. Chapter 17. A Night at the Opera. So, Saturday. I wake up early, stung by the realization that I said yes when Jim escalated to formal, but the only suitable outfit I've got that's not 5 years out of date is a bit risky. So I brave the autumnal clouds and the weekend shoppers, and head for Peter James and competitors. In the end, I do not buy a new dress because everything that looks good doesn't fit, and vice versa. On the other hand, once I've spent hours fruitlessly wandering department store floors, my existing gown doesn't look so extreme. So I end up buying something much more useful. A calf-length black coat with silver detailing. It's cheaper than a posh frock, and I can get a lot more mileage out of it. I then blow what's left of my budget on a frivolous sequined clutch, opera gloves, and a new pair of court shoes with heels just tall enough to help me look Jim in the eyes without crippling me. I get home at 2 in the afternoon, hungry, tired, and suffering from just a little ennui at the frivolity of it all. I'm old enough to know better than to play dress-up party doll for a man, especially when I'm not married to and need to be able to look in the eye next week at work. Or to blow a ton of cash on shoes and a handbag and a ticket to the opera, when I could just as easily rent it on DVD. Never mind the whole dating in the workplace thing. That can go horribly wrong in so many ways that it's not even funny. On the other hand, there hasn't been a lot of frivolity in my life these past few years, has there? Let alone fun. and Jim and I are both grown-ups, I tell myself. I can handle this, as long as it doesn't go too far. So I chow down on a very austere edamame salad I bought on my way home, then go upstairs to shower, and begin preparing myself for the ritual of a formal night out. A kind of formal that Bob and I haven't done in longer than I care to remember. Around 4, my phone buzzes. I pull it out of the evening clutch. It's a message from Jim. Want me to pick you up at 5:30? Yes, I send back. Then I go into panic mode. I've showered and done my hair, and I'm half-dressed, but I'm not ready. The next hour passes in a blur. Finally, I look in a mirror. A stranger looks back at me, sleepily sophisticated, all lip gloss and crimson nails. She doesn't look like me at all. Her red hair, the grey stragglers dyed into compliance, hangs loose in a waterfall over the shoulders of her lace-topped black gown. She's a striking stranger. My princess world twin sister. There is jewellery. A silver chain supporting a discreet silver bangle, earrings, bracelets that contain heavy-duty wards. It's as if I'm looking into a magic mirror that shows me who I might have grown up to be if I'd settled on trophy wife as my life's ambition in secondary school. All look at me, rather than look at what I do. I wouldn't want to be her every day, but it's an interesting role to try on for an evening. I pull my new shoes on, wiggle my toes to make sure they still fit as well as they did in the shop, go downstairs, proving I can walk in them without breaking my neck, and pull on my coat, just in time for my phone to ring. Hello? It's me. We're parked outside. Want to come out and meet me? Sure, I say. I check that Lecter's asleep in the safe, energize the wards, arm the burglar alarm, and let myself out. There is a stretch limo sitting in front of the house. It's not huge. You'd never fit a full-length one through London's twisty suburban streets, but for our purposes, it counts. Jim stands beside the door, holding it open for me. He wears a tux well. I suddenly no longer feel overdressed. He takes my hand with a smile. I hope this meets with your approval, Mom, he asks, as I climb in. There are wide leather seats and a minibar in front of us with a bottle of sparkling wine sitting in a silver tub. Jim climbs in next to me, fastens his seatbelt, and leans forward. We're ready, he tells the driver. The opaque divider in front of us whirs up, then the car begins to move. The suspension is very soft, and a good thing too. Jim fills 2 champagne flutes and hands one to me. You look marvellous, he says quietly. I almost didn't recognise you. Slightly starstruck, I take the glass. And you've outdone yourself, you smooth mover. I thought we should start as we mean to go on. He looks quietly smug. Might as well celebrate our success. To success, I say. Chink of glassware. I take a sip. Bubbles in my nose. Past and future. It takes 30 minutes for the limo to rock and sway across the bridge and into the heart of the theatre district, by which time our glasses are running dry. But rather than offering a refill, Jim raises a finger. Nearly there, he says. Nearly where? I ask. Surprise! The car pulls in beside a slightly grubby red carpet that runs out to the curb. Then I see the restaurant awning. Oh my! I'm not used to dining in restaurants owned by chefs with their own TV show. Don't worry. The pre-theatre option is very reasonably priced. We have... He pushes back his cuff to reveal an antique Rolex Oyster. 75 minutes. And we have a reservation. They'll be ready for us. He hands me out of the car, and we walk together to the door, which a uniformed doorman opens before us. I feel very self-conscious. but not in my usual bad, vulnerable crosshairs on the small of my back way. Once inside, an attendant takes my coat. Jim's pupils dilate as he sees my dress properly for the first time. "Good golly, Miss Sakamoto, you're beautiful," he misquotes. "Science," I whisper with emphasis and grin at him. His answering smile is qualitatively different from anything I've seen on his face before. And for a moment, the part of me responsible for self-restraint hopes that I haven't gone too far. Dinner is a blur. Small portions designed not to inconvenience the stomach of the theatre-goer. It's beautifully laid out, but not terribly filling. Jim's conversation is witty and entertaining, and we skirt around work delicately.
"If only we could organise the whole planet as well as you've organised your department," Jim says wistfully. "You could bring about world peace and abolish poverty and crime. Except, we'd have to elect you planetary overlord first."
"Nah, I'm really not up to that job," I tell him. "Anyone who could do it well is sane enough not to want it. Anyone who wants it is by definition unsuitable. Anyway, it's a committee job. Even being head of state for one country is too big a job for a single person to do without a whole team working behind the scenes. What do you say?"
"At ACPO team building sessions, we have this discussion on days with a Y in their name."
He pauses to eat a mouthful.
"It's called the Setting the World to Rights session. You can probably imagine the direction it takes when you get a room full of 20 mildly inebriated senior police officers with PhDs in sociology or criminology. It's probably a good thing they don't have their hands on the levers of power then. When your tool is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. They run the police, QED. They're not quite as simple-minded as that," he says mildly.
"No, of course not." I reach across the table and touch his hand reassuringly.
"But rules are rules,
and their career path has conditioned them for decades to believe that laws should always be enforced even-handedly. Rule of law and all that. It's not their job to ask how the laws are made and who benefits from them. Rules are fine for machines, but human beings aren't perfect spheres of uniform density and negligible frictional coefficient."
"Ah, the spook's viewpoint."
His lips purse in good-natured amusement.
"Any number of shades of grey."
We finish up in the restaurant. I go to powder my nose, and while I'm gone, Jim summons the limo. As we reach the front door, it's at the end of the red carpet waiting for us. He booked it for the whole evening, I realize, with a frisson of doubt and secret excitement. I'm conflicted, unsure how to react. Bob moved out a couple of months ago, but I'm not ready to put a dot at the end of that sentence and move on. It's all a bit fast. On the other hand, it's fun and magical and an excuse for escapism. Romance, even. Bob is many things, but there is not a single romantic bone in his body. Whereas Jim, who one might expect to be a stolid, plodding policeman, has a barely submerged romantic streak as wide as a motorway. Setting the world to rights, indeed. The opera itself is almost an anticlimax. Verdi, doomed lovers, romantic tragedy. What more is there to say? It is, needless to say, a solid, reliable performance with one or two call-outs. Jim has found us seats at the front of a large box, but it's also home for the evening to other groups. Corporate executives in their wags, and in some cases habs. They're all dressed to the nines, so we don't stand out. It makes for an odd combination of intimacy and anonymity. And so we sit knee to knee for 2.5 hours. The final curtain call is over. The lights come up. Conversation rises around us.
"The evening is still young," Jim murmurs, "and the magic carriage won't turn into a pumpkin until 1 o'clock. What do you say?" I say, "Hello, evening." He offers me his arm. I take it, and we return to the limo, one of several queuing patiently outside the crush in front of the Royal Opera House. I slide into it gratefully. "Where to next?" I ask. "I have something in mind." His eyes twinkle wickedly. He knocks on the partition. "Destination 4, please." "Wait, we're..." The car begins to move. "It's a surprise," he says, quietly. "Do you trust me?" I look him in the eye. "This is all a bit fast."
"I'm sorry. If you want, I'll give you a lift home immediately."
"No, that won't be necessary." I relax. He's fast, but smooth, and he knows when to back off. He's a grown-up. More grown-up than Bob will ever be. Is that what I've been missing? A real grown-up man in my life? I'm not sure. I'm not sure I'll ever be sure, frankly. His attention is flattering, very flattering. I'm absolutely dead certain he's been working up to this for some time. But he's given no hint of it before now. "Surprise me," I tell him, stretching luxuriously.
"Happily. It'll take about 20 minutes to get there. Would you care for a top-up?"
And so we get through our second champagne flute of the evening. Sometime later, we pull up alongside another red carpet.
"You can leave your coat in the car," Jim tells me. "He'll pick us up when we're ready to go."
So I shed my heavy outer shell, and Jim helps me out of the limo, and we walk along the runner. There are reporters here, paparazzi. One or two flashes go off, and I almost flinch before I realize that they're not aimed at me.
"What is this?"
I hiss in his ear, a rictus smile baring my teeth at the world as I lean on his arm.
"Look up."
I look up.
"Wow, it's Minas Tirith."
"Yes. The red carpet leads to a glass entrance and an atrium with a ceiling high enough that our office building could fit comfortably under it. We're at the foot of the London Shard, the tallest building in the European Union. It's pretty small beer by Chinese or American standards. It doesn't even make the top 50 skyscrapers worldwide. But it's the tallest here. And Jim is leading me across the lobby red carpet towards a bank of express elevators.
"I scored 2 tickets to a very exclusive party," Jim confides in me. "I'm afraid this qualifies as work, not pleasure. Hope you don't mind."
I tighten my grip on his arm. "Damn it.
Why?" "I thought you ought to be here to see it."
"To see what?"
"I got wind of it yesterday afternoon from a source at the Yard, via the Integrated Intelligence System. It's a meet and greet for persons of interest to our host, His Eminence, Sheikh Omar al-Nuaimi. I very much doubt he'll be seen in public here tonight, but there may be some discreet invitations to his apartments downstairs from the observatory level. Most of the guest list are investment bankers and political lobbyists, but word is that he is extremely interested in meeting 3 Sigma Powers. I barely had to express interest. Ah, here we are."
The spacious glass-walled lift to the observation deck is stunningly fast and smooth, and my ears pop on the way up. We don't have it to ourselves, mind you. The other passengers are a mix of middle-aged couples and younger and more glamorous hangers-on, all in evening dress. Nobody I recognize. At the top, the doors open, and white-gloved attendants direct us out onto a floor, which serves as an open-air viewing platform. It's surrounded on 4 sides by giant triangular glass walls and support trusses that extend several stories above us. We're sheltered from the wind, but it feels light and airy and a little bit chilly, a harbinger of early autumn. Waiters with drinks trays and bottles circulate discreetly. Jim and I both accept glasses of white wine.
Do you recognize anyone here? I ask.
Jim scans the room slowly.
Not yet.
There are about 40 people present so far, with more arriving steadily. I think I recognize one. She looks vaguely like Persephone the auditor. If I squint and try to imagine how she would look in a couture gown with her hair scraped back and lacquered until it gleams. I'm not sure, I say. Got one possible, but she's one of ours.
I've got another, Jim says quietly. Not a POI, I'm afraid.
She's an assistant commissioner in the Met, and my boss's boss. That rank might sound junior, but it actually puts her three levels above Jim, a brigadier to his colonel. I briefly wonder if we've blundered into a black tie version of the man who was Thursday, updated for a new century. Might be best to avoid her. I propose gently steering him away from the direction he was scanning. Arm in arm, we slowly pace the length of a stupefyingly high glass wall. This whole meet-and-greet for superpowers thing might have worked out a lot better if the Sheik hadn't specified black tie. They don't exactly stand out when they're not wearing skin-tight lycra with capes, do they?
Indeed not.
We reach the corner and turn.
Uh-oh.
Approaching us from the other wall is the woman Jim zeroed in conversation with a distinguished-looking fellow with a white goatee and thick glasses. She looks to be about my age, wearing a rather plain dark blue evening dress.
"Ah, I thought I recognised you,"
she says to Jim. To me, a brief pro forma smile.
"Hello, I'm Jim's boss's boss, Laura Stanwyck."
She extends a hand. We shake. This must be Matrix Management Central then, because Jim is working part-time for me, I tell her.
Oh.
She suddenly focuses on me like a hawk.
Then you must be Dr. O'Brien.
I let go of her hand.
I've read a lot of reports about you,
she says dryly.
Not much of it negative.
Thank you.
Shame they've thrown you in the piranha tank at the deep end, she says.
Another brief smile.
Good show yesterday.
She turns to Jim, implicitly dismissing me.
Jim, we need to talk about implementation of the plan sometime next week. It's imperative that we move forward with all due speed.
Yes, Mom. Jim casts me a worried glance.
Can this wait until Monday?
I suppose it'll have to. She glances at me.
See you around. Can't say, must circulate. Toodle-pip.
She collects white goatee, who is swaying slightly and contemplating his nearly empty wine glass.
Come along, dear.
Jim stares after her.
Well, I never.
Never what? I take his arm. Surprised to learn that assistant commissioners are married?
No.
He trails off.
But I hope she hasn't got on the wrong end of the stick about us. Here. Let's circulate.
We'll never know if anyone interesting is here if we pretend to be wallflowers.
Suddenly, I realize that I am standing far too close to the glass, and I am backlit, making me a perfect sniper target. I take three long steps sideways, then turn round furtively as I tug my gown back into place.
Sorry,
I say.
Jim looks concerned. You're very twitchy tonight.
I left my violin in the safe. Old security reflexes. Let's stay away from the walls from now on. We circulate for what feels like the best part of an hour, while we drain our wine glasses. We pass the woman I suspect of being an auditor once more, but she's so elaborately made up that it might be her evil twin, and in any case, she gives no sign of recognizing me. Nobody is casting fireballs or levitating or crushing coal into diamonds. It's just a very boring reception for the sorts of movers and shakers that a moderately Anglophile sheik might invite round for a Saturday night's entertainment.
This is crap,
I confide in Jim's ear, around the time my glass is empty and my feet are beginning to ache from the hardwood floor.
Want to split?
He whispers back.
Yes.
I lean on his arm.
If we got the database up and running and had a contact sheet memorized, this might have been useful, but as it is, we're a couple of weeks too early. Get me out of here?
Jim sends a text, and the long black beetle shiny limo is waiting for us at the end of the Red Runner when we arrive at the bottom of the lift shaft. Everything about the shard is calculated to make you feel bug on a microscope slide small. The celebrity perp walk down the carpet seems to take forever. And for some reason, too many glossy magazines, I suppose. I keep a fixed grin on my face the whole way. I'm falling into an acting role again, rather than being myself as I was for a few hours in Jim's presence. Then I feel his strength through his arm and I snap back into my own head. Only now, I have an impulse to lift my shoulders and stick my chest out and tap my heels as I walk. Because Jim is magnificent, and he needs a glamorous catwalk companion. And I want to be the sort of glittering woman who belongs on his arm, because this sort of setting comes with a natural, magical glamour of its own. Look at me. The smile feels natural as I tighten my grip on him. Then he opens the car door and hands me in. Once the door is closed, the car begins to move.
Where to? He asks quietly. I can take you home if you want.
I am intensely aware that we're in the back of a limo together, on a slippery leather seat that slides half flat. I'm still holding his hand, and I'm keeping myself from sliding down the seat mainly by digging in one heel and bending my knee so that it pushes into view. I'm not wearing the lace stockings I picked for Bob. No, I chose sheer black silk for tonight. Suddenly, I feel very wicked. I want you to take me home, I tell him, taking his hand and tugging it across to rest on my knee. But you choose the route, fast or slow. Then I lean towards him, and he kisses me. I don't know how long we spend in the back of the limo. Time flies by when you're having fun. On the other hand, we're in a car, and kissing and cuddling is all very well, but I'm still a bundle of unresolved internal conflict and zinging energy. I haven't completely lost my grip on myself. I want to have fun, damn it. I've had precious little in the past month. But an icy cold part of me also wants to be able to go to work on Monday and look my co-workers in the eye. Nor am I quite certain I'm ready to give up on Bob for good. The self-doubt finally prompts me to cool things a little. Jim follows my lead because, I suspect, he too is mature enough to realize the consequences if we take this to its logical endpoint. One-night stands with co-workers are so not my thing. So we pause on the threshold, and I don't invite him in with me when the car pulls up outside my front door. Thank you for a wonderful evening, I tell him with heartfelt gratitude as I pull my shoes on.
No. Thank you.
He pauses.
I was not expecting this turn of events. I mean it.
He sounds slightly shaky.
I'm touched.
Well, I say awkwardly. We kiss again. I need to get my head around it, Jim. It's been a wonderful evening, but I don't know if it will still be wonderful if we go too fast.
Well then, we shouldn't do that,
he says, as level-headed as I could hope for.
Talk tomorrow?
Definitely, I say. Then before I'm tempted to change my mind and invite him in, I climb out of the car and walk to my house alone. Part of me is kicking myself for not throwing caution to the winds, but I've got a lot of questions to answer before our next date. Up to, and including whether I want to try and salvage my marriage first. And something tells me I won't have very long to think about it. I go upstairs and shed my glamorous mirror world skin, then crawl into bed alone, except for Spooky, who parks herself precariously on the footboard and stares at me with huge dark eyes. Bloody cat, trying to psych me out. I fall asleep and dream, of course.
And it should come as no surprise at all that it's a classic anxiety dream, bubbling up from my conflicted, lonely subconscious. I dream that I'm walking through the darkened streets of London, sometime in the early hours of the morning. It's cool, and it's been raining recently, and a chill wind raises goose flesh on my bare skin. Naked, because this is the classic anxiety dream, the one where you're in the nude and everyone else is wearing clothes. A voice I know only I can hear is calling me, telling me to catch the tube. If I don't, I'll be late home, late reaching safety and security. Which is silly because the tube shuts down at 1 a.m. and the traction power stays off until the first trains start running again shortly before 6 a.m. But dreams don't have to make logical sense. So I scuttle between darkened doorways, avoiding masses of wind-strewn litter and the odd sleeping homeless person. Heart in mouth, I cross Whetstone Park, tiptoe up Gate Street in the dark. Two police officers on foot patrol walk past on the opposite side, certain to see the naked woman crouched in the doorway, but they look right past me and keep on going. In this dream, I am naked, but I have the middle-aged woman's unwanted superpower of social invisibility. What kind of sense does that make? Dream logic. This is definitely a dream, because in real life, you would not catch me walking the streets naked after dark. Nor would I carefully descend the dozen or so steps to the gates of a locked tube station. I slip through the barrier, then chain the gate shut behind me. The escalators are stilled for the night. Their metal steps are sharp and cold under my feet as I descend in near darkness. I've got a feeling, an urge, that the compass in my skull is telling me to proceed to a familiar platform. Platform 5. Aldwych Branch, the other nagging strand of my unsolved Casey's anxiety. I walk along the short platform until I come to the end. The signals are set to red and the track power turned off, but I still shudder. Something scuttles and moves in the tunnel entrance. Tube mice. I cross the warning barrier at the end of the platform and climb down onto the track bed. My feet ache continuously now, for I've been abusing them constantly for hours. Shiny new heels, then barefoot on the street. I walk into the tunnel. Help! It's the still, small voice of my demon lover, my muse, my curse, my destiny, floating in the darkness in front of me. It's Lecter, abducted and abused, held hostage by strange powers that want to tie him to a new bearer. I stumble and shuffle along through the darkened tunnel for an infinitely long time. Track ballast scratches at my feet when I slip. I catch myself on the cold, rough brick and cast iron lining of the wall. I walk past rows of arched recesses, survival trenches for tube workers. In my dream, they serve as niches in an ossuary, each one filled by the on-end coffin of a plague pit burial, open to reveal their occupant's final deathly grimace. Heavy cables snake alongside at ankle level, secured to racks bolted to the walls. Anxiety dream redux. My subconscious couldn't frighten me with naked on the streets of London, so it's iterated through loss anxiety to a healthy dose of cytodromophobia. Beware. For some time now, the tunnel has been descending and curving to the right. It's dark as a night with the new moon riding low, only the odd emergency light and signal showing me the way forward. The relatively bright platform is lost in the distance behind me. But I have walked past a point signal repeater and can just make out something irregular and metallic at ground level. I touch the wall. It feels different, smoother. I run my finger along it, walking slowly forward until it roughens again, perhaps 10 meters further along the tunnel. Back up, says the voice in my head. I back up obediently, and then I trip over something hard and cold at ankle level. I catch myself as I tumble. And then I am no longer walking along a tube tunnel. This is a wider corridor, with a wooden floor and scuffed tan-painted walls. Doors opening off to either side. It's clearly backstage at a theatre or performing venue of some kind. It curves and I'm in one of the side rooms. It's an instrument store, with stands and piles of cases full of orchestral equipment. The instruments that don't usually go home with their owners. Here, a row of kettle drums. There, a wooden cabinet full of tambourines, triangles, and other minor items.
"Over here,"
calls the quiet voice, and behind a row of stacked wooden chairs, I find a familiar battered white violin case. My heart pounds as I reach out and take it. And then I am clutching his case in front of me, as if it's adequate concealment, while I shiver on a floodlit stage in front of a full house. A very familiar house. It's the Royal Albert Hall. And I'm on stage wearing only my goose-flesh-raised skin. And every seat is full. The audience staring at me accusingly. Their faces are pale, indistinguishable blobs that seem to hover in the twilight. Somewhere between the collars of their uniform shirts and the brims of their custody helmets.
"If the lead violin would care to take her seat?"
The conductor is gently sarcastic as he chides me in lector's borrowed tones. There is a throne. No other word is fit to describe it. At the centre of the stage, below the organ, where the soloist would normally stand. This being lector's dream, I might have expected monstrous charnel furniture assembled from interlocking bones, but as I shuffle backwards towards it, violin case still clutched defensively between my body and the silently staring disapproval of the audience of faceless officers, I realise it is made of thousands of stacked police notebooks.
"We are waiting for the lead violin,"
the conductor explains to the audience. I am nearly at the throne of evidence when I realise that the violin is no longer in his case. I'm carrying him in one hand and the bow in the other. And there's something wrong. A body in blue steps forward. Shadows skeletally grinning under his helmet, as with bony hands. He positions a manuscript on the monstrous music stand that sits before the violin soloist's throne. I know that score. I've performed it a dozen times in my dreams over the weeks since the British Library robbery. I see the conductor's face for the first time. Or rather, I don't. Because I recognise him from his absence. And he's in the high-security lock-up at Belgravia, where we put him after the takedown on Downing Street, isn't he? "You can't make me do it!" I shout as I throw Lecter's bow at the mandate. Lights snap on overhead. A concussive blast of photons that scorch the back of my eyelids. I cower and cover my face with one arm. Figures step forward, out of the photo-rhodopsin-stained background. Two in front, two closing in behind me. Daft Punk Territorial Support Group Judge Dredd empty uniforms, the uniforms Ramona had designed for my people, close in around me, raising power-assisted gloves that contain no human fingers. The naked woman versus the empty suits.
"You're nicked!"
The uniforms chant in unison as they grab me and twist my arms painfully behind my back. I can't breathe. They ratchet a pair of handcuffs closed around my wrists, ziplock my ankles together, drop a bag over my head, and lift me to shoulder level. I'm suffocating as I open my mouth to scream, but there is no air here. Just a tongueful of warm fur. With an angry chirrup, Spooky plants a surprisingly cold pad on my cheek and stands up, flexing her claws. I realise I'm lying alone between damp, chilly sheets, breathless and heart-pounding in the wake of a suffocation nightmare. I resolve never to complain about Spooky sleeping on my face again. Then I get out of bed and go downstairs to check the wards, and Lecter's safe.
because you can never be too careful.
Sunday is as Sunday does. I spend it prosaically, catching up on housework chores and trying not to ask myself whether what I feel for Jim has the potential to turn serious. This is, of course, like trying not to think about green elephants. Once you start consciously trying to avoid it, it becomes impossible. So I pop a sleeping pill at bedtime. And it is a distinct relief when Monday morning rolls around and I can dive back into a distracting office. The first thing I do when I get to my room is to park Lecter in the securely warded safe. Then I fire off an email to Dr. Armstrong asking if he has a spare hour. To my surprise, he gets back to me right away. This lunchtime is available. So that corner of my diary is penciled in for a chat about these dreams I've been having, and by extension about Lecter, and other more worrying things. Last week, I decreed that from today, we'd be starting up regular Monday morning management meetings, just to keep all department heads in the loop. The unit, with an effort I remind myself that we're now officially a force, is big enough that we have to crawl out of the Precambrian jellyfish swamp of bottom-up organisational structure and grow a management backbone. I don't know everything that's going on anymore, and although I know all the names and faces of the people working under me, there's no way I can stay in touch with what they do. Ergo, delegation, and the bane of management that ensues. Endless meetings. For now, the meeting team consists of Ramona, Mary, Jim and myself. So we hold it in my office over coffee, and it's blessedly short. It's going to change soon enough, though. I can see the writing on the wall. I get my first surprise of the day when I ask, "Do we have any other business?" Jim nods. "Yes, I got a memo via the Home Office. It's about the inaccessible tube station. BTP got a resolution. It turns out there's some other agency involved. Aldwych has been shut for years anyway, and apparently TfL agreed to transfer it to this other agency on a 5-year lease without telling anyone, including the on-site guards." His cheek twitches. "That's..." Mary shakes her head. "Crazy?" I ask. "Do you know who the agency in question is?" Jim's frown deepens. "As it happens, I do." He glances at Ramona, then Mary, then back at me. "Promise this won't go any further?" "Promise." I stop dead, just as Ramona nods slowly. "I think I see where this is going," she says tonelessly. Mary's eyes narrow.
"Spill it,"
she tells Jim. Jim nods very slightly, then glances at me.
"I'll thank you for not spreading this any further," he tells us. "But you know full well that most police officers have not been briefed about the existence and true purpose of the organisation you people really belong to."
"The laundry's true purpose?" I shrug.
"Yes, but..."
I stop.
"You're not telling me," I begin. "It's the Specialist Crime and Operations Department."
He clears his throat, a worry frown forming at the corners of his lips, his eyes.
"Very few of them, almost none of them, are cleared for laundry-related material. And someone up top, high enough to have tons of clout, but nevertheless not on the briefing list, decided that in view of the rising tide of super vandalism, it would be a good idea to have a deep bunker for incident command and containment of dangerous individuals. I mean, you saw how small and under-equipped the cells at Belgravia Nick are."
I nod. "Carry on."
"It came from the top down a while ago, and I didn't get the memo because I was on secondment. It was while we were on that fisheries jaunt. Aldwych is being rented until the Crossrail TBMs can be redeployed to build as a proper facility. If we get the budget for it, of course. So the first element of the rebuild was to shut off street-level access. Once reconstruction has finished,
They'll partly reopen the stairwell, but, as an oubliette, so that villains can be sent down, but can't get back up. They're going to run it like an ICBM silo, with watch crews on duty and underground access only via special trains. He looks disapproving. The next Criminal Justice Act will make changes to our ability to detain suspects for questioning without charge, just to make this work.
Well, that's... I hesitate to say nice. How good of them to keep us fully informed, Ramona chirps pointedly.
Jem avoids her gaze.
I roll my eyes. People, please, let's try not to get into the habit of saying what we think all the time.
Ramona is actually right. The Met setting up a secure supervillain nick without telling us stinks like a month-old fish. It reeks of manoeuvring under false colours. Someone in the executive suite is trying to cut us out of the action on our own turf. What else might they be hiding from us? But it's impolitic to say that sort of thing aloud, especially on the record.
I'm very sorry,
Jim finishes his coffee.
But it's strictly hands-off.
There's some kind of pissing match going on in the executive suite at the yard. At a guess, they've got a couple of deputy commissioners squabbling for who gets to run the new specialist command. You don't get to that level without being a political officer, if you follow my drift. Doubtless, they'll end up making a bid for our unit in due course. He sounds disgusted.
Save me from empire builders.
He pauses.
It's probably worth my skin if word gets out that I told you this.
Well, that's just peachy. I manage.
Don't worry.
Your secret is safe with us, Officer Friendly. So, do we have anything else to talk about this morning? It turns out that there is nothing else to discuss, which is probably a good thing. They say if you start each day by swallowing a live toad, nothing can possibly make it worse. But after that piece of news, I'm not so sure. And then, my day really begins to turn to shit. I'm shutting down my laptop to go and do lunch with the senior auditor, when I get a voice call from Alison in HR.
Dr. O'Brien?
She sounds worried. Hi. You caught me on the way out of the office. Is there anything I can... I do a double take and nearly facepalm. Is this about Jim Gray?
Yes. Yes, it is.
I'm on edge immediately, because there's a brief pause between her words that doesn't feel right. What's the problem?
Well, you asked me to look into his medical background and the details of his armour and, he puts me in a sticky position. I'm afraid I can't help you. I mean, I can't. Medical files are legally privileged information, but you mentioned his armour? I can confirm that it's definitely unpowered. If you've seen him walking through walls in it, that's entirely due to his own powers. It's also tailored closely to fit. I am allowed to say that he first manifested superhuman abilities nearly 14 months ago. Doctor, I know this isn't my field, but if he isn't being screened for Kay syndrome on an ongoing basis, he could be heading for big medical trouble.
I put the phone down with an oh shit sensation in the pit of my stomach. Not just the usual headache of sending one of my staff for a bunch of tiresome medical tests and juggling rotas to cover for him, but a nauseous sense of dread. Good news. Jim's armour isn't haunted. If I see Officer Friendly flying around, then he's Jim, which means he isn't holding out on me. Isn't a sock puppet for Freudstein. Bad news, though. Jim's vulnerable. Just like any other occult practitioner. And something in me balks at the idea of exposing him to threats that force him to use his superpowers in ways that make his grey matter a tempting tidbit for the feeders. But that's the sort of threat I'm supposed to expose him to daily, as part of our job. It hasn't been a problem with Bob for ages. His entanglement with the Eater of Souls protects him, just as Lecter insulates me from their attentions. But Jim is vulnerable, and I can't be detached about it anymore. I've fallen into a conflict of interest. So I'm feeling particularly fragile as I catch the tube across London, feeling naked again in the absence of my instrument. Being out and about on business without a violin case slung over my shoulder simply feels wrong. Try to imagine James Bond without a gun, or a martini in sight. It's incongruous, isn't it? But I have to leave Lecter behind in a secure storage lockup, because I'm on my way to have lunch with Dr. Armstrong to talk about the white violin. I'm not sure Lecter can hear exactly, but he can tap into my senses eerily well at times, and I have a feeling that having him listening to the conversation I intend to have would be a really bad idea. And so, to the office, with the disturbing dimensions and the secret stash of really rather good single malt. Not that I plan on consuming any. I need my wits about me.
Ah, Mo! Come in, come in!
Most people do office casual only on Friday, if at all. So I'm slightly taken aback to be confronted by the SA in a knitted wool cardigan and tartan bedroom slippers. I enter anyway.
Is something the matter?
He asks, focusing over my shoulder. Yes, I think so. I let the door shut, then sit down in his visitor's chair without waiting to be invited. It's about Lec. I'm sorry. It's about the white violin. And it's about officer friendly as well, but mostly the violin.
Ah, so it's time for that conversation.
He mutters as he sits behind his desk, takes his spectacles off, and polishes them with a microfiber cloth. He glances at me, his gaze startlingly intimate without the intervening crystal barrier that normally screens him.
How far has he pushed? Speaking to you in your dreams? Sending you entirely new dreams? Or actual possession? All of the above,
I admit. Although the only incident of possession so far was when, bleeding on the fretboard, as the bow drags my fingers across blue glowing strings, a terrified pale figure crouching before me in the living room. In a moment of extreme emotional stress and exhaustion, I was confronted by what I perceived to be a threat.
And?
He prompts gently. I shudder. Bob was there. He managed to talk me down before anything too bad happened.
Well.
He picks up his half-moon reading glasses and puts them on, then carefully adjusts them before he looks at me. His delay doesn't inspire confidence.
How long ago did that happen?
The morning after the code red. The SA nods thoughtfully. Is it just my overactive imagination, or is he really disturbed?
It would have been good to have known the full scope of your reasons for misgivings earlier,
he says, slowly, choosing his words with the care of a man walking across an uneven icy pavement.
I think I may have underestimated the urgency of your earlier concerns, Doctor. Are you sure you can continue to control the white violin? What do you call him?
Lecter. It slips out before my internal sensor can block it. And he winces visibly. I carry on, feeling distinctly reckless. And no, I'm not sure I can hold him in check at all times. When I took down Stripjack Spratt, Lecter nearly weaseled me into strangling him. I had a big fight with him a couple of weeks ago and threatened to chuck him in the English Channel if he didn't stay out of my dreams. He backed off then. But it's only a matter of time before an incident crops up where... Well... As long as he gets his blood, I think he'll do what I want. The problem is, what happens if I have to stand down before he's fed? I stare at the backs of my hands. I feel as if I just confessed to personal inadequacy. Get it off your chest, they say. But nothing about the hollow dread. The unanswered question, what happens next? That fills your mind after confession. Somehow... While I've been carrying the bone violin, the veins and tendons have risen to the surface. Flesh falling away from the metacarpals. Skin loosening and losing its elasticity. Thinning. becoming almost transparent. It's been years, and I'm growing older, and I'm just too tired to arm wrestle with dream demons whenever I need to do my job. I look up at the SE. I can keep him under lockdown, and only bring him along on major incidents. I can probably continue to do the job on that basis for a while longer, but I'm losing fine control, and sooner or later, there'll be an accident. Dr. Armstrong stares at my eyes. Then he nods. Just a slight inclination of the chin. I don't need to tell him what an accident means, for which I am profoundly grateful. I can tell he's imagining the writing on the wall, sprayed in the arterial blood of innocent victims.
I understand, he says softly.
An ambiguously pensive expression tugs a curtain of worry lines down across his forehead, gathered in swags by the corners of his eyes.
You've reached the limit of your ability to control the white violin, and if you continue to do so, the risk of an unacceptable incident will rise sharply.
I nod, unable to trust my voice.
Very well, then.
He pauses.
Mo, what I am going to say next is in strictest confidence, and must go no further. In particular, you must not share this with your staff. Any of them. Do you understand?
What the hell? I nod again, utterly taken aback.
The police and Home Office rely on police intelligence assets for their situational awareness.
His diction is fussily precise, as if he's repeating a briefing paper he read and memorized for just this contingency.
In particular, police intelligence is oriented towards supporting police operations. It has to deliver evidence that will stand up in court. It is constrained by rules that do not necessarily apply to defense intelligence organizations.
Like us, I interpret.
Defense intel organizations, in contrast, operate under rules of compartmentalization that might seem excessively onerous to the police, who take a more collegiate approach to apprehending bad actors. So, I'm going to ask you to take it on trust when I assure you that it is utterly essential to the agenda of Operation Incorrigible that you continue to act as the White Violin's custodian until the end of this month, for another 3 weeks. You can and must take steps to minimize the risk of collateral damage. Keep the instrument in a warded safe at all times, only remove it in response to an emergency, cease regular practice with it. I can arrange a prescription for strong sleeping pills if necessary, but I need you to continue in your current role until the end of the month.
I lick my lips. Why? What agenda? What happens then?
Then?
He smiles humorously, as he ignores my first two questions and evades the third.
Then you can set down your burden.
The violin will either go to a new carrier.
He's bluffing.
We've got nobody else remotely strong enough to pick up the instrument. Lecter would eat their soul and turn them into a pithed zombie within an hour.
All be consigned to a secure repository until such time as we are forced to revisit the balance of risk versus safety. You will be retired from that particular duty, but in any case, I believe we are due to review your career development path in preparation for your forthcoming promotion. You'll have plenty to keep you busy.
Forthcoming promotion? What forthcoming promotion? He said, we. That means the auditors. I'm still puzzling it over, when he continues.
The real purpose behind Operation Incorrigible is that we have reason to believe that the organization operating behind the cover identity of Professor Freudstein is fully aware of the white violin and intends to make a play for it.
It's like a punch to the guts. As Bob would say in one of his more annoying Reddit moments.
Wait, what is this? I don't even.
The violin is a seriously classified asset. Most of our sister agencies don't know about it, much less random mad science villains. I managed to restrain my reaction to a terse.
You cannot be serious.
Oh, but I am. At some point in the last minute, His smile warped into a grimace. And that's all I can tell you, other than to point out